This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
The TSA turnaround. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
For travelers in 2015, there were no consistent major delays at security checkpoints at U.S. airports. What a difference a year makes. Hear what's changed over the past 12 months.
As more states consider approving legalized marijuana, the rules of the road are getting complicated. How much pot is too much for drivers?
In sports, how world number one Novak Djokovic turned around his serve to become the best player in tennis.
And how today's college grads can avoid getting stuck in mom and dad's basement.
This comes down to fight or flight. You know, kids and people in general rise to the expectation that's given to them. If we got the Obamacare that says you can stay on their insurance for 26, and we got other things, parents are just jumping in line with that and saying, hey, I get it. I understand, you know, the economy is hard. You can stay home longer, or we'll pay that car note or that cell phone bill a little longer until you can get on your feet.
Entrepreneur and author Ryan Gilliam looks at how young adults with new diploma in hand can get going in life. He's here later in the hour. Here's something to think about when it comes to this year's unusual political climate, the recession that started in 2007 and the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009 scared and scarred the electorate more deeply and more permanently than has been recognized before. That's the conclusion of Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau Chief Jerry Seib. Jerry, how do you see it?
Well, I think one of the things a lot of people have been trying to figure out, including me, is why this year politically has been so strange and unpredictable. What's going on that has produced outcomes that almost nobody saw coming, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump being the principal ones, and kind of the demise of a whole series of, you know, seemingly impressive but fairly conventional Republican presidential candidates. And I think that, you know, if you look at the public polling, one of the conclusions that you're drawn to is that basically, the scars of the 2007-2008 recession and the 2008 financial collapse were deeper than probably people realized. And more importantly, I think the mental hangover from that has been much longer lasting. It continues to today. And so even people who look at the economic statistics and think or are supposed to think that there's been an economic recovery don't feel that way. And they've been scared and disillusioned by this. And I think they're reacting in ways they would not have been they would not have done ordinarily or in other times.
All right, so will people vote differently, or are they voting differently right now, or is there just more energy?
They've been voting differently all year. I mean, you know, the fact that Donald Trump, you know, did what he did in the primaries, and the fact that Bernie Sanders continues to plague Hillary Clinton, who's, you know, a very competent but very conventional candidate, tells you that people are searching for something unconventional, and that's not a revelation. I think the question has been, why? And I think the answer is, at least in part, I think that, you know, that the trauma of the financial collapse, which was felt widely and in some cases by some people at least deeply, has been very real. And I think that though the statistics tell you there's been a recovery, I think mentally people think, you know, they were let down by the system. They still feel that way. They're still scared. Even if they have in their own personal life recovered, they can't seem to get over the fact that they feel like they've been burned, and I think they're reacting accordingly. And that's at least part, if not the biggest part, of the explanation for this. And it's borne out by the fact that you continue to have people who say the country's off on the wrong track in our polling, for example, even though the economic statistics are supposed to tell them the recovery has been underway for 6 years already. They just don't seem to buy it or don't feel it.
Why didn't we see this in 2012 when the recession was, well, what, 3.5 years over at that point?
Well, I think people were still sort of sorting it out in 2012, and you know, I think that they, I think there might have been a feeling then that you know, the economic course would return to normal, and it really hasn't, in the sense that there's been a very weak recovery. And I think that what's happened now is that I think people have stepped back and decided that a weak economic performance feels like the new normal to them. It confirms their feelings that, you know, that there's something wrong with the system, and they think that more strongly now than they did in 2012. Ironically, even though again the statistics tell you the recovery's been underway from well before 2012 until today.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau Chief Jerry Seib. His piece is called "Economic Scars Help Explain Bizarre 2016 Race." How long do these scars generally last?
Well, you know, the permanent is, I think, one of the ways of looking at it, you know, that people never forget. And, you know, I think the Great Depression was similar. People who went through the Great Depression and emerged on the other side of it and got on with their lives eventually never forgot the way they felt then. And, you know, that was a reason that Franklin Roosevelt arrived and the New Deal arrived, and that there was a kind of an a political impact from the Great Depression that lasted, you know, through basically, I think, through the lives of people who went through the Depression. And one thing people are starting to wonder about, and, you know, public opinion experts are wondering whether this is kind of now a permanent scar that people who've been through this will carry on through, and it'll have political impacts for a long time to come.
Have political leanings changed because of this, or is there just a different energy, or is a message being sent here? How do you read this?
Well, I think that there's a there may be a realignment politically underway. I think that, you know, the Donald Trump effect on the Republican Party and the Bernie Sanders effect on the Democratic Party are very real, and I think that how the two parties emerge from this is a question. I don't have the answer to that, but they may emerge different in a different shape than they entered this period in. As a result of this, we'll find out more after November, I think, but probably for years to come they'll be sorting themselves out.
It's Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau Chief Jerry Seib. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
A great business needs a stunning website. And with Wix.com, you can do it all by yourself. Wix.com makes it easy to look amazing online, no matter what type of business you're in. Show off your images in a beautiful gallery. Grow your contact list and get all your social media in one place, just the way you want. Your customers are going to love it. So, what are you waiting for? Show the world what you can do. Go to Wix.com and create your stunning website today. It's easy and free.
Time now for a travel update, and it's brought to you by Lexington Hotels. At Lexington Inns and Hotels, our highest priority is providing you with exceptional service at a great rate. Visit LexingtonHotels.com for reservations and locations. The number of air travelers hit a record during the summer of 2015, yet there were no major problems with delays at security checkpoints. A year later, hundreds of infuriated passengers are missing flights every week as they wait hours to navigate security. What changed? Here's Yahoo Finance columnist Rick Newman. Rick, what do we have?
It's not a simple story, which might surprise people. Everyone thinks there's just TSA is just kind of an incompetent agency. That's Transportation Security Administration. TSA has actually been thinking a lot and doing a lot of things since 2011 to make those airport security lines go faster. And something quite interesting happened last year, which is the Inspector General for the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees the TSA, did a secret test and sent what they call red teams to the security checkpoints in a bunch of different airports to see if they could sneak through banned items, you know, the sorts of things that the TSA agents are supposed to catch, things that terrorists might try to sneak through and get onto a plane. And it turns out they were successful. They actually were able to get banned items through security checkpoints. This was somewhat alarming. And while the exact details are classified, it forced the TSA to sort of reverse some things they had been doing to ease up on security lines.
You talked to someone at the Government Accountability Office who said at the TSA there's been a long time tension between the primary mission of security and the secondary mission of supporting the free flow of commerce. Is that pretty much the heart of the issue?
That is the nut, absolutely. And it's interesting because the TSA itself, the agency that is actually manning those checkpoints, they're often trying to do things to make the lines go faster and they're getting into arguments with other elements of the people in the Homeland Security Department, for instance, who are saying, nope, you can't do that. It compromises security. So when you get into the details of what's going on inside the bureaucracy, the TSA actually sides with, in many cases, with making the lines move faster. And it's other parts of the Department of Homeland Security. In this one instance I mentioned, it was the Inspector General saying, nope, you cannot do that. We are going to make you stop those expedited procedures because we are concerned they compromise security. And what we're seeing this summer is a bit of a move back toward security, and we're going to have to give up a little bit of convenience in order to get it.
We're speaking with Yahoo Finance columnist Rick Newman. His piece is called The Surprising Reason Airport Delays Are Suddenly So Bad. You also talk about the new airline website called I Hate the Wait, which is meant for passengers to share information.
Yeah, the idea is sort of data sharing. It's kind of, they're hoping it'll be sort of like Waze for anybody who knows that smartphone app, in that if people are at the airport and they say, man, it's terrible. I'm in checkpoint in Terminal B at O'Hare or wherever they might be. I've been standing in this line for 2 hours. Well, then other people who have flights that day might check in and say, wow, I need to get there faster, sooner than I thought. It's voluntary and people have to actually make the effort to send information to the website in order for people on the other end to get useful information from it. So I think it's unproven. I'm not sure it's going to work, but it's a resource. And of course, if you have a complaint and you just want to vent, you can do that as well.
So until Washington gets this figured out, Rick, what alternatives do passengers have?
One good idea, if you have not yet booked a flight, is to see if you can first of all, fly off-peak because many of these delays are happening at peak flying times, which is not surprising. But some airports are just maxed out in terms of the capacity. They don't have any room to add more security lanes. And there's just not a lot they can do to ease the pressure. So if you are able to fly, at times when everybody else is not flying, that's a good idea.
Thanks, Rick. Yahoo Finance columnist Rick Newman. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. World number one tennis player Novak Djokovic sticks to a gluten-free diet, is a fitness fanatic, and is dedicated to meditation. Those may be contributing factors to his success, but those aren't the only things. Besides forehands and backhands, he's really gotten good at serving over the past couple of years. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
It's tough to get to the top and even tougher to stay there. That's why the world's best athletes are constantly tweaking their games. In tennis, Novak Djokovic has made some changes to his serve. Tom Parada, contributor to the Wall Street Journal, has the details. Tom, what did Djokovic think was wrong with his serve?
It was a complex process in 2010. His serve was very, very weak. But essentially, from talking to experts, he's changed a bit of his technique, how he brings up the racket when he serves. He was getting it up a little bit late and not in an ideal spot, which made it tougher on his shoulder. And he's just worked really hard on precision and sacrificed a little bit of speed for more accuracy. It's sort of like learning how to pitch in baseball. Just imagine someone who's really good at a fastball to start, and then they realize, if I hit some corners and I throw a little less hard, I'll actually get more outs more quickly.
When you're an elite athlete at the very, very top of your game like he is, how difficult is it to make a major change in your game?
It's not easy. I mean, I think it takes a lot of honesty with yourself. It can be tough because he was winning pretty well, but I think for him it was something that wasn't that hard in the sense of the mentality, because he was at number three in the world for a long time, always behind Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal. And in 2010, I think he realized we've got to do a little bit better at this to get to that top spot.
We are speaking with Tom Parada, a contributor to the Wall Street Journal, about Novak Djokovic. He's also made some other changes, diet and fitness. What are some other things he's done?
He's gone on a gluten-free diet. There's been a lot of coverage of that. That was back in, he figured that out in 2010. He's now what he calls pescatarian, which is vegan, but he eats fish sometimes. He meditates. He's very, pretty monastic in his approach. Works really hard at all different things. He's hired Boris Becker as his coach a couple of years back now, and that seems to have helped him with his mentality and also with his serve. And, Novak's always been really good at pretty much everything. His strokes are very solid. He's a great mover. He's improved his fitness. And put it all together and you have a player who doesn't really lose very much.
We are now in the heart of the Grand Slam season. Is he the favorite in every one of these going forward? And is he separating himself from the Roger Federers and Rafael Nadals and Andy Murrays at all?
Right now, he's the favorite everywhere he plays. As long as he's healthy, he's going to be the number one guy. It doesn't matter the surface or the tournament. He won the Australian Open. He's a pretty good favorite to win the French Open, which he's never won before. If he does that, he would go on to Wimbledon, where he's a defending champ. And if he does that, he would go on to the U.S. Open, where he's a defending champ. No one's won all four Grand Slam tournaments in a year since Rod Laver. It's been a long time. He could do it. He has the game to do it. But I think people don't realize sometimes it's very, very hard. A lot of things have to go right. You can have a bad day. You can be a little unhealthy. You can have a cold or whatever it may be. So I'm not sure that, you know, if the chances are great that he'll do it, but he's going to be the favorite at every tournament he plays for sure.
Tom, looking at the men's side in general, do you think Roger Federer and Nadal are kind of on their way out a little bit because of injuries and age?
It's tough to say. Roger's 34 years old. That definitely catches up with you. He's incredibly healthy and smooth on the court and works hard. Nadal, it's a little bit trickier. He just had a wrist injury and had to pull out of the French Open, which was a surprise to everyone. And he's played a much more physical game over the years, and that's more his style of play rather than, you know, winning games more easily with serves. So you would think the physicality hurts him a little more. I still think they have a couple years left, barring, you know, bad luck.
One more question for you. The state of the men's game for U.S. players. We've got John Isner, Jack Sock. Do you see any of those guys making a breakthrough in a Grand Slam, winning one?
Isner's been really steady for years and needs a lot to go right to win a slam. His movement just isn't quite as good as some of the other top players in the world. He's got an incredible serve and powerful forehand. Jack Sock has a lot of upside still, really great forehand, and he's a big, rugged kid. I think the good thing with American men's tennis is the generation who's younger than that, there's a lot of talent there. Kids like Taylor Fritz and Francis Tiafoe, Tommy Paul, there's others. Kids who have done really well in the junior rankings, which is usually a pretty good indicator, working hard. And, you know, 4 or 5 years from now, I think you'll see some of that pay off. But it's been a long time. We haven't had an American man win a Grand Slam since Andy Roddick at the 2003 U.S. Open. That's an incredibly long stretch.
Wow. Forgot about it. It's been that long. Wall Street Journal's Tom Parada with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. 30 minutes now after the hour. Looking for the next place to grow or expand your business? Why not look to a state that's a top 10 pro-business state, where 2,000 unnecessary regulations were eliminated over the past 5 years, and is now home to the 6th best entrepreneurial climate? All this and more awaits you in the state of Michigan, the state that should be the number one choice for your business. Go to MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. Massachusetts does not have a law to define impaired driving from marijuana, and the topic results in disagreement among scientists. Kay Lazar at the Boston Globe explores the question, how much pot is too much pot for drivers? Kay, what did you look at?
Well, what we tried to do is figure out if there was any level of amount of marijuana that is considered safe for driving, because unlike alcohol, which everyone uses a 0.08 blood alcohol content for measuring whether you're impaired, marijuana laws, as far as driving, are really unclear. So we talked to researchers who study this issue and also some lawyers and tried to figure out how much is too much.
Wow. All right. How about like an expert state like Colorado, for example? Do they have any rules regarding this?
They do. They're one of a handful of states that actually measures specific amounts, 5 nanograms of what's called THC, the psychoactive ingredient chemical in marijuana, and they measure that in your blood levels. They are just one of a handful of states, 5 or 6 states, that actually do that. Most states do not have any specific law. For instance, Massachusetts has no specific law for measuring the amount of THC in your blood.
Wow. All right. So if, for example, in Massachusetts, you get pulled over, a police officer smells where marijuana, sees your glassy eyes or whatever, what can he do? Did he book you for, reckless driving? Or because he can't tell if you're impaired on the spot, I guess?
Well, my understanding from speaking to lawyers and reading material that was available is that they can still cite you for impaired driving, because obviously if you're doing something that looks crazy or unusual to them, they can pull you over and they can give you a field sobriety test, right? So they can, you know, the old adage of walking a line,
oh,
or trying
true.
to determine your balance, et cetera. So they can certainly give you field sobriety tests, but then obviously if it goes to court, they have to get an expert who would testify about that type of behavior. They can also later measure your blood and see that there is an amount of THC in your blood, the chemical in marijuana that is psychoactive. But our law does not have what's called a per se, meaning, you know, a specific amount that says you're impaired, for instance, like Colorado does, or the way most every state has 0.08 blood alcohol in it. We don't have that, and most states don't have it for marijuana.
Mm. We're speaking with Kay Lazar, health reporter at the Boston Globe, and she's got a story entitled Marijuana and Driving, How Much is Too Much? So I thought it was interesting, too, the one researcher you talked to made a distinction. He said basically with too much booze, you make errors of omission, but with pot, it's errors of commission. Explain what he meant there.
Yes, I thought that was a great way to explain it. So what he said is, you know, with too much drinking, if you're drunk driving, you'll run a red light. So you're not doing things you're supposed to be doing, like stopping at red lights, checking your rearview mirror. He said if you're driving stoned, obviously on pot, then you're going to stop at green light. So it would be just the opposite. In other words, you are being so hyper-focused and you're doing things very differently than if you were on alcohol. You're not omitting things like forgetting to look in the rearview mirror. You're just so focused on something that you would just stop at a green light because you're trying to think through the fog type of thing. I mean, trying to get researchers and trying to get research about the differences between marijuana and drunk driving and how it affects your brain is really challenging. I was speaking to another researcher who said there really wasn't a lot of research and studies done comparing the two. So that's kind of an interesting way to look at it, too.
Is anybody working on some sort of reliable breath test that could be administered by police, you know, in the field?
Apparently there are, and I've been told this. I did not find that. We did not try and track them down. But I've been told by researchers that there is quite a lot of work going on to try and figure it out, because there's nearly 24 states that allow marijuana for medical use and more are considering it. And obviously Massachusetts is considering legalizing marijuana for recreational use in the ballot in November. So clearly more and more people will be using marijuana and presumably driving. So I think there is a real need and a real desire.
Thanks, Kay. Kay Lazar at the Boston Globe. 21 minutes now before the hour on this weekend. Want to avoid having your kids live in your house after they graduate college? Are you a college grad who desperately wants to avoid the stigma that may be attached with relocating to mom and dad's? Author and entrepreneur Ryan Gilliam explains how in a book called The Cost of Greatness. Ryan, what'd you write about?
65% of parents expect to support their children after college. After they spend all that money and putting them through college, they now have to support their children after college, and that's kind of becoming the new benchmark or what the expectation is to support your kids through way past 22, 25 almost.
Oh, goodness. I didn't realize for that long. I did, I don't know, 6-8 months, I guess, before I fled the nest after college. But this is how many years afterwards are we talking about here?
Well, it varies, you know, from family to family in different regions, but pretty much 3 years they're expecting, you know, to support their kids after that, and it's becoming almost, in my opinion, an epidemic, and we just can't continue it that way.
Wow. Why is this happening?
Well, there's a lot of different reasons, but in my opinion, I would say it just comes down to fight or flight. You know, kids and people in general rise to the expectation that's given to them. If we got the Obamacare that says you can stay on their insurance to 26, and we got other things that are kind of setting up easier path or more convenient path for post-college graduates, parents are just jumping in line with that and saying, hey, I get it. I understand, you know, the economy is hard. You can stay home longer, or we'll pay that car note or that cell phone bill a little longer until you can get on your feet.
But this doesn't sound right, though. Or is it the nature of today's economy? I don't know. How do you approach this?
I don't approach it with a very sympathetic voice.
Okay.
Because I had a job in high school. Had jobs in colleges. You know, I didn't have that kind of opportunity. And I think it helped me. It helped me having to pay my bills. And if I didn't pay my bills, I was going to fail. You have to have that pressure, unfortunately, the grind of life, getting up and doing the same thing every day in order to, you know, to pay your mortgage. And if you don't have that sense of responsibility, if you know you have that savior of the parents coming behind you, is something I talk about in my book, The Cost of Greatness. You're not going to be as ahead of the game as some other people who are truly truly understand what it is to fight and grind and succeed.
We're speaking with Ryan Gilliam, author and entrepreneur. His book is called The Cost of Greatness, and we're talking about how today's grads can get out of mom and dad's basement and on their own. Speak to those maybe who may have recently tossed their caps and graduated, or maybe the sophomores, juniors in college, or I don't know, those in high school. What would you say?
It's all about preparation. So the college degree we know isn't what it used to be as far as a bachelor's, but those externships, those internships, those opportunities that you can take to volunteer and get those letter of recommendation and other things, they're essential now. You have to be willing to work for what you want. And if you wait till it's too late, meaning you already graduated, you're just another name in the inbox of an HR company. You've got to put yourself out there, sit outside somebody's office. You've got to take the opportunity to set yourself apart, literally, by completing internships, externships, volunteer hours at different companies. You know, get your name out there, get your face out there, and do what other people aren't willing to do. That will definitely set you apart.
Self-made millionaire by the age of 30. How'd you pull that off?
I was blessed to have a lot of mentors. Outside of the grace of God, I was had a lot of mentors who poured into me, and all I did was emulate and follow instructions. You know, there's nothing new under the sun, and if you find someone like one of my main mentors was Leroy Selman, a great businessman, also who was an NFL Hall of Famer, yep, who taught me a long time ago that if I would just stick to it, keep my head down and grind, things will work out. And I think just like if someone's in the stock market and they're a trader and they're always kind of jumping from one thing to another, they're not going to, you know, pay off, just like your Warren Buffett's who stick to it. And it's the same kind of approach in life as in careers. So all graduates, you know, take your career seriously, take the minimal steps, and just stick to them, and they will pay off in the long run.
Thanks, Ryan. Ryan Gilliam, the book is called The Cost of Greatness. 13 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend.
You're a small to mid-sized business with 300 to 3,000 employees. You face the same network security challenges as big businesses do, but can't support a big IT investment, leaving your doors open to advanced cyber threats. Barracuda Next Generation Firewalls provide all the core features of enterprise firewalls and UTMs, but without hidden costs and deployment hurdles, making owning a big business firewall no big deal for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Next Gen Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/firewalls.
To most people, Louisville is best known for bourbon and baseball bats, maybe bluegrass music. But during the late 1970s, the local Omega National Products factory just about cornered the market in disco balls, churning out a vast majority of the dance ornaments made in the U.S. The company shipped thousands a month. Wall Street Journal reporter Ariane Campo Flores paid a visit. Ariane, what did you find?
Officials at the company I visited, which is still there, and Omega National Products, said that they produced about 90% of the disco balls made in the U.S. In the late 1970s. And they were just churning out thousands of these a month, sending them off to nightclubs, to roller rinks, to concert halls, what have you. It was a major part of the company's revenue at that time. It has since then dwindled to only about 15 or 20 a month, but they are still cranking them out, and one of that original crew at the height of the 70s, a woman named Yolanda Baker, is still there, 69 years old, and still making them by hand.
Oh, by hand? Is that right? What goes into that?
So they start off with, this company does a lot of work with like mirrors and mirrored glass, and so what they do is take these sheets of mirror, the process is really fun to watch, and then they run it through this machine that scores it, and basically they run it through twice, and what it produces are just those little cubes that you see on a disco ball, and what she then does is kind of break them, separate them, and then just cut it into strips of these mirrored strips of glass that are kind of laid on a cloth. And she just basically takes these aluminum orbs and puts glue on them and glues on these mirrored strips.
How about that? So who are the buyers these days? Just typically clubs or what?
Yeah, there still are. I mean, they mainly sell to distributors who then will sell them off to clients. There are still I mean, disco balls are still popular in nightclubs and in venues. There are, you know, numerous ones in New York City and other clubs that use these. There was a nightclub in Atlantic City that is actually using the mirrored sheets made at this factory in Louisville to coat this really high-tech disco ball that they're about to unveil there at a nightclub, 6 feet in diameter, but it also has these little perforations that allow these LED lights inside to shine, you know, create images on the ball. So it's not just sort of reflecting light that's bouncing off it, but shooting out images for nightclubs. So they're still popular, but obviously nothing like what it was like in the late 70s.
All right, thanks, Arian. Arian Kempo Flores, Wall Street Journal reporter. Whether or not customers will benefit remains to be seen, but with Charter Communications buying Time Warner Cable, it's likely there will be one benefit: no more confusion about the Time Warner name. Time Warner Cable is often confused with Time Warner, home to HBO and Warner Brothers. Time Warner Cable was spun off 7 years ago, but customers apparently didn't get the memo. The Wall Street Journal says angry emails are often directed to Jeff Bukes, the CEO of Time Warner, about lousy installations or customer service. In return, Mr. Bukes refers them to Rob Marcus, the CEO of Time Warner Cable. That name, by the way, will be phased out in the coming months. It even confused demonstrators, unhappy that Time Warner Cable dropped the Arts Channel Ovation from its lineup back in December 2012. They showed up to protest at Time Warner offices at Columbus Circle in New York City. A helpful security guard showed them they needed to be a couple of blocks further north at Time Warner Cable offices. That'll do it for this program. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.